This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Afghan government announces the death of Mullah Omar, the Iran nuclear deal questionable for potential international business, Africa faces an acute shortage of meningitis C vaccine.
If we don't manage to put together this 5 million stockpile, we will be not well armed to respond to the epidemics that may hit Africa next year.
A singing contest winner makes a move to stardom. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Afghan government officials say that reclusive Taliban chief Mullah Omar is dead and that he died more than 2 years ago in Pakistan. President Ashraf Ghani's office said Omar died in 2013, but the Taliban itself claimed that Omar is still alive. In Washington, the White House said the reports of Omar's death appeared credible, and the U.S. intelligence authorities are looking into the circumstances surrounding it. It was unclear why news of Omar's death was just now emerging, although there have been other reports of his death since 2001. That was the last time the one-eyed secretive head of the Taliban was seen in public after U.S.-led forces toppled his government and he fled over the Afghan border into Pakistan. The death of Mullah Omar, a close ally of the al-Qaeda terror network, could complicate or even scuttle a second round of peace talks set to begin Friday between the Taliban and the Afghan government. Ayaz Gul in Islamabad tells International Edition host Susan Yaki the Taliban may face an internal power struggle.
Obviously, this is a big blow. If these reports are true, and if the Taliban at any point in time after this presidential statement also confirms that its leader is dead, then this is going to damage the entire peace process that has just been started like maybe 3 weeks ago. And this second round of negotiations, which was due in Pakistan and which is, as of this moment, confirmed to take place near Islamabad on Friday. Sources close to this whole process here in Islamabad say that if Mullah Omar's the reports of Mullah Omar's death are true, then there will be the purpose of these negotiations will also be dead, because on the table, whichever Taliban leaders will be sitting talking to the Afghan delegation will have no unified leadership after Mullah Omar's death, and it could really lead to serious disintegration within the Taliban ranks, and there could be a serious infighting for who is going to lead the Islamic movement after the death of Mullah Omar.
Do we know why all this news is coming out now?
Well, that's the question everybody is raising, that if the Afghan intelligence knew that Mullah Omar died 2 years ago in Pakistan, why were they sitting on this information for 2 years and waiting for a moment when there's a lot of hope in the region that as a result of this nascent Afghan peace process, there could be peace in Afghanistan? And the importance of these negotiations could be gauged from the fact that Chinese and American officials are also sitting as observers on the table when the two sides are negotiating. And for this round of negotiation, which is due on Friday, American and Chinese observers are also coming to participate. And as Daniel Feldman, the special U.S. representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, he was in Islamabad today and he spoke to a group of reporters, and he was quite hopeful that this process where the U.S. officials will be sitting as observers could lead to peace in Afghanistan. So there was a lot of hope and optimism that this Afghan peace process could lead to end of hostilities in Afghanistan. But with this news of the Taliban's leader, Mullah Omar, being dead, obviously, it's a major setback for this whole effort in which Pakistan, the United States, China, and other allies of Afghanistan are playing a role to promote peace in Afghanistan. This process will seriously suffer if the Taliban now confirms that Mullah Omar is dead.
Ayaz Gul in Islamabad speaking with International Edition Susan Yaki. Mullah Omar led the Taliban when U.S. forces invaded Afghanistan in 2001 after the September 11th terrorist attacks against the United States. The Taliban supported al-Qaeda and sheltered its leader at the time, Osama bin Laden, who took credit for planning the attack by hijacked airliners that killed almost 3,000 people in the United States. Omar had been the supreme commander and spiritual leader of Afghanistan since 1996. After fleeing into Pakistan, he dropped out of sight after the U.S. invasion that followed the 2001 attacks on New York and Washington. Time now to find out how social media are reacting to the apparent death of Mullah Omar. Michael Lippin is here with details. Michael, what's the big hashtag on Twitter?
Hi, Ray. Well, you know, the big one today really is hashtag Mullah Omar, and that is his name. It's been tweeted about 10,000 times in the past day, and it's according to the Topsy Analytics website. I've even seen the hashtag Mullah Omar dead. But is he really? Well, we haven't yet had confirmation or proof from the Pakistani side, and some media outlets have picked up on that uncertainty. One of them is U.S. news site The Daily Beast, which tweeted this headline to one of its reports, "Mullah Omar dead again," and then it wrote this in parentheses, "for the third time, in case you weren't counting." Well, The Daily Beast article is actually titled, "Rumors of Mullah Omar's death have been greatly exaggerated before," and the article quotes terrorism expert Thomas Joslin as pointing out that the Taliban has routinely released statements attributed to Omar each year, including just recently. And the article notes that Joslin said, "I doubt the Taliban has been pretending that he has been alive because there are just too many people who would have to keep quiet about that."
If Omar's death really is true, Michael, what have other experts been saying about what that could mean for the region?
Well, one prediction that I saw that's getting attention is from the Washington-based analyst Michael Kugelman of the Wilson Center. His handle is at Michael Kugelman, and he sent out a tweet saying that he believes Mullah Omar's death provides the Islamic State Group, or ISIS, with its biggest recruitment tool to date in Afghanistan. Kugelman also included a link to his latest blog for the Wall Street Journal, where he elaborates on that prediction that ISIS could fill a vacuum potentially left by a leaderless Taliban. Other commentators have highlighted the timing of the news of Omar's apparent death. One of them is Pakistani education activist Musharraf Zaidi, whose handle is at Musharraf Zaidi. He's got 98,000 followers, and here is what he tweeted. "News of Mullah Omar's death is big for sure. But the bigger story here is the leak's timing, 48 hours before the Afghan Taliban meet the government to discuss peace terms." Well, another prominent Pakistani rights activist, Ahmed Qureshi, believes that India is behind the revelation. Qureshi's handle is at AQPK, and he has 87,000 followers to his name. Qureshi tweeted this, "India floated the Mullah Omar death story to disturb Pakistan-sponsored talks between Kabul and the Afghan Taliban." Well, we'll just have to see if India responds to that conspiracy theory. Ray?
Thanks, Michael. You can follow Michael on Twitter. His handle is at Michael_Lippin. That's L-I-P-I-N. And this is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Turkey is now directly involved in the war against the Islamic State, using its air force to strike targets in Syria. Turkey will also work with the U.S. and other nations to create a safe zone in Syria where people will not be subject to the terror of the Islamic State. While Turkey's air force is in action, its army is not, for now, moving into Syria to engage the Islamic State. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with Sinan Ulgen, chairman of the Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies in Istanbul, about why Turkey is holding back.
Little discussion of that, given that there is no willingness on the side of Turkey, or no demonstrated willingness at this point, to engage directly Turkish troops. The reason is that this would bring about a number of considerable problems for Turkey, not only from the standpoint of national security, but also from the standpoint of international law, Turkey's relations with countries like Russia and Iran, and so on. So there has, for the time being, the plan, now that Turkey is fully involved in this fight, is to support the efforts of the coalition by opening up the İncirlik Air Base and two more air bases in the southeast of Turkey, but also involving the Turkish Air Force. There are strikes that have been undertaken against the Islamic State targets. But that's really the extent of the direct engagement of the Turkish army. The plan that seems to be agreed between Ankara and Washington calls for members of the Syrian opposition to strengthen and to consolidate this zone free of Islamic State elements.
While the fighting in Syria goes on, Turkey continues to provide shelter for a massive number of refugees from that conflict. Sinan Ulgen describes the massive strain this is putting on Turkey.
The official figures indicate that there are about 1.8 million Syrian refugees in the country. About 280,000 of them are in camps that are set up for that purpose in the southeast of the country. But the rest are across Turkey, Istanbul being one of the hubs where apparently there are about 300,000 Syrian refugees. So this is indeed a huge issue for the Turkish government, given that there has been very little burden sharing on, you know, when we look at Turkey's neighborhood. Turkey, it's not only in terms of financial costs, but also there are a number of services that need to be supplied to these people. So health services, education services, and so on. And eventually, given that the Syria situation, the conflict in Syria, is not to be solved anytime soon, this is likely to be a long-term challenge for Turkish policymakers.
That was Sinan Ulgen, chairman of the Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies in Istanbul, talking earlier with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. U.S. lawmakers pressed top administration officials Wednesday for details on the international inspection regime that will enforce a landmark nuclear pact with Iran. In a testy exchange consistent with Capitol Hill's generally frosty reception of the deal, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Republican John McCain, vented frustration over Congress's inability to review agreements between Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency. Senator McCain said that Iran has a clear record of cheating, and in his words, "We know that with any agreement with a country such as Iran, the devil is in the details." Secretary of State John Kerry addressed the topic, saying the U.S. negotiating team had been briefed on the inspections regime, and members of Congress in turn would be briefed behind closed doors. The Republican-led Congress has 60 days to review the nuclear accord. Votes could come in September, and it is almost a foregone conclusion that both chambers would reject the deal. What remains to be seen is whether enough supporters of the pact materialize to sustain President Barack Obama's promised veto of congressional votes of disapproval. American business interests are looking for opportunities in Iran, but it might not be easy. VOA's Bernard Schussman met with some business experts in New York to discuss the Iran nuclear deal's economic impact.
With an agreement that puts strict limits on Iran's nuclear development for 10 years, the international community will lift economic sanctions. But there are plenty of hurdles before U.S. and global businesses invest and sell to Iran. Iran expert Suzanne DiMaggio says Iran is a potential market for 80 million highly educated, sophisticated consumers ready for U.S. products and services. But
it will take some time for major U.S. corporations to feel comfortable enough to start investing in Iran. They'll need to see that Iran is working through this agreement, is complying with it. They also will want to see that there's some stability there.
A key to stability is oil. Iran has some of the largest oil and natural gas reserves in the world. But during the years of sanctions, the oil fields have not been fully developed.
So it is going to take some time and billions of dollars to really bring that oil sector up to snuff. But make no mistake about it, Iran will be a major player in the oil sector. I think this has other countries like Saudi Arabia worried. What will that do to the market that's already so far down?
When Iranian supply comes on the market, securities trader Ben Willis predicts oil will settle at around $40 a barrel.
Right now, the market's reacting by buying the major oil companies like Total, Exxon, and the big oil producers throughout the world. That being said, I think part of the places that are not being looked at right now is look for the international investment banking firms that have been thrown out of Iran or have been forced to leave by sanctions. They'll be allowed to go back in.
New York University economics professor Paul Wachtel points out the sanctions do not get removed immediately, but he is optimistic.
If this agreement leads to Iran being reintegrated into the global economy, you've got a brand new big player in the world economy. It will be good for world trade generally, would be good for many American industries, consumer goods, producers' goods, airplane industry, oil equipment, lots of American industry.
Young people are looking forward to more involvement in world social media. But the question is, will the Iranian regime open up its economy and liberalize its economic relationships with the rest of the world? Bernard Schussman, VOA News, New York.
The World Health Organization says Africa is at risk of a large meningitis outbreak next year. It says an acute shortage of meningitis C vaccine is endangering the lives of thousands of people in the 25 countries that constitute Africa's meningitis-prone areas. Lisa Schlein reports.
The UN agency is calling for vaccine manufacturers to step up production by 5 million doses before the 2016 meningitis season starts in January. Unfortunately, this appeal appears to be falling on deaf ears, according to William Perea, an epidemiological officer with WHO.
The vaccine manufacturers are not willing to ramp up the vaccine production to make these 5 million available to WHO to respond eventually to the epidemics in the next season. If we don't manage to put together this 5 million stockpile, we will be not well armed to respond to the epidemics that may hit Africa next year.
Another problem is price. Meningitis C vaccine can cost between $30 and $50 a dose, much higher than meningitis A vaccine, which costs about 60 cents a dose. Meningitis is a bacterial infection that can cause severe brain damage. It is fatal in 50% of cases if left untreated. The introduction of a vaccine against meningitis A in 2010 has successfully protected millions of people in Africa from getting this disease and prevented its spread. Meningitis C has not been seen in Africa since the 1970s. However, cases of the disease have been rising since it reemerged in Nigeria in 2013 and 2014 and in Niger this year. WHO reports 12,000 cases of meningitis C and 800 deaths in Niger and Nigeria in the first 6 months of this year. The World Health Organization plans to convene an expert meeting in October in Geneva to try to understand why meningitis C is reappearing in Africa after an absence of nearly 40 years. It says many questions have to be answered for health officials to be able to control this disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
What do fish and dinosaurs have in common? That story coming up. This is VOA News.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? How about 1.7 million videos, all recently posted on YouTube, courtesy of the Associated Press and AP's British Movie Tone channel. 1943, World War II, and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill.
We are far better prepared to endure the worst malice of Hitler and his Huns.
1974, Muhammad Ali at his rhyming best before fighting George Foreman in the country, then known as Zaire.
Ali fights great. He's got speed and endurance. If you sign to fight him, increase your insurance.
1990, Movie Tone is there when Nelson Mandela walks out of a South African prison.
Mr. Nelson Mandela, a free man, taking his first steps into a new South Africa.
World history through the cameras of the Associated Press, the world's largest and oldest news agency. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition in Washington. An estimated 66 million years ago, an asteroid hit the Yucatan Peninsula. The event triggered a global mass extinction and is linked to the demise of the dinosaurs. New research in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences finds what emerged from that apocalypse was a modern age of fish. VOA's Roseanne Skirbel explains.
66 million years ago, the ocean was a different place. Sharks and octopus-like creatures were big players, but paleontologist Elizabeth Seibert says there were others.
There were also many marine reptiles that were swimming around. And of course, there were fish. Absolutely, there were ray fin fish around. It's just that they weren't very dominant.
The University of California, San Diego graduate student and her professor compared microfossil fish teeth and shark scales in sediment cores that dated before and after the mass extinction.
And basically, the deeper down you get, the older you get. So we looked at sediments from about 75 million years ago to about 45 million years ago, looking every 200,000 years in some cases, looking every 10,000 years in other cases.
Prior to the mass die-off, the ratio of fish to shark was stable, but that changed dramatically when the asteroid hit.
We see that instead of having about equal number of shark fossils and fish fossils, we see that the fish fossils more than double. And that trend continues while the shark fossils stay approximately the same.
The study suggests that the extinction event killed many animals at both the top and bottom of the food chain, opening niches to the ray fin fish, which today represent nearly all fish species.
And they radiated into all of these newly vacated spots and possibly some new things that wouldn't have existed at all if the extinction hadn't happened.
Seibert says her next step is to go back to the microfossil record to find out how the fish responded to other stresses in the ocean, like global warming. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
She won the voice singing competition here in the United States under coach Blake Shelton. Now Cassidy Pope has a new single, inspiring people everywhere. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong about Pope's tune called I Am Invincible.
If you're a fan of the U.S. TV show The Voice, you know who Cassidy Pope is. You know she was the first female winner of that competition, and you know this girl can sing. Nikki, she's got a new tune out now, and it's called...
I Am Invincible.
All right.
Yes, it is a self-empowerment theme built to last, make it through to the end, sort of like Katy Perry's Raw,
right.
Rachel Platten's Fight Song, which is popular now, too. And she debuted the song at the Special Olympics, which I think was fantastic and appropriate. And it has already, upon its premiere, has climbed to number 4 on the real-time Billboard and Twitter trending 140.
Uh-oh.
So this is good news for her.
Uh-oh.
Now, in it, she talks about, now, she didn't write this song. But she says it resonated with her for several reasons. She's been writing a lot, and she's been under a lot of pressure to craft a hit for her sophomore project. But this song, because it combined her love for rock and her country roots, and lyrically it resonated with her, she said it just felt very inspiring and empowering. And the song indeed is that. I'm invincible. I'm unbreakable. I'm a diamond cut to less. I'm unstoppable. I'm a hero. Like a phoenix from the ash. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Invincible.
And it's, you know, it's kind of like one of those songs, like Whitney Houston's One Moment in Time,
yes,
that was associated with the Olympics.
Yes.
And, you know, you see people overcoming adversity in
exactly.
the Special Olympics and being invincible, you know,
yes.
that's great. I mean,
yes.
I can just picture it in my head,
yeah.
you know, somebody crossing the finish line of a race.
Yes, yes, and saying, I am invincible. I know the words are talking about, I'm unbreakable, I'm a diamond cut to last, I'm unstoppable, I'm a hero like a phoenix from the ash.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'd give you goosebumps just listening to it. Wow. Now, you mentioned this is her sophomore project. She was on, as we said, Team Blake for The Voice.
Yes, she was.
And she won.
And she won.
And so she's kind of got a guardian angel in Blake Shelton, too, right?
And he has encouraged her. He said, you know, you're a different kind of country artist because of her rock influences. And he said, but be true to yourself. And she's endeavoring to do that for this project. She said she has been writing with so many people. I know she's written with Kit Moore. She's worked with Nathan Chapman. She's worked with Lady A's or Lady Antebellum Charles Kelly. She has a surplus of material, but she's really trying to narrow it down to the songs that really represent who she is.
Thanks a lot, Nikki. If you would like to send Nikki a tweet, you can do that at VOA underscore music. You can send us one at VOA underscore IE. You can also listen for Country Hits USA. That's Nikki's show. Dial that up on our website. That's www.voanews.com.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Burundi's controversial presidential election is over, but the political crisis there continues following the National Electoral Commission's announcement that President Pierre Nkurunziza has won with over 69% of the vote. The balloting and electoral process have been broadly criticized as non-credible by the East African community and international partners, including President Obama during his recent visit to Kenya. The election, which was boycotted by opposition parties in protest of President Nkurunziza's intent to run for a third term, and the government's efforts to close media outlets and shut down political space, leaves the East African nation divided and in the throes of continued political turmoil. Many have criticized the government for violating democratic norms and for going forward with the voting despite the clear absence of conditions necessary for credible elections. The opposition says the president's re-election bid violated the Arusha Agreement, which ended Burundi's devastating civil war and remains the bedrock of the country's fragile stability. Major donors have suspended assistance and threatened to impose sanctions in response to the discredited electoral process and to hold accountable those responsible for human rights abuses. The commission's announcement on the electoral results culminates a deeply flawed electoral process, one marked by violence and a disregard for the civil and human rights of the citizens of Burundi. The United States is deeply disappointed by President Nkurunziza's violation of the Arusha Agreement and use of undemocratic means to maintain power through an electoral process that was neither credible nor legitimate. Moving forward, it is imperative that the government of Burundi re-engage in a meaningful, serious dialogue with opposition and civil society leaders to reach a consensus on how Burundi may regain the trust and confidence of its citizens and the international community and prevent even greater instability, economic collapse, refugee flows, and violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.